And this is Pedro Reyes. You are tuned in to KPFA 94.1 FM. And right now on the line, we have George Galvez, who's going to be telling us about what's going on with an event that's going to be taking place in Oakland. And he's working with the CURYJ. And he's going to let us know a little bit about that as well. So welcome to the show, George. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on here. I appreciate it, brother.
Right on. So tell us a little bit about what the event's about and where it's going to be at in Oakland.
So, well, maybe if it's good, man, I'd like to kind of rewind a little bit, just give a little background. I'm sure your listeners have been just kind of following. I know a lot of KPFA listeners are pretty savvy about just movement building nationally, and particularly across the nation. We've had a lot of movement building around police terrorism and holding police accountable for just a lot of egregious abuse and lack of accountability, and we've just seen a lot of, police terrorism in our communities, black and brown communities in particular, and sort of the on-the-ground response to that. And so the reason I wanted to kind of go back and provide a little context is because, a lot of us, on the ground are kind of thinking about these issues on multiple levels. There's the grassroots organizing around these issues and direct actions and demonstrations, shutting things down, shutting business down. Particularly in the brown community, one of the things we noticed was kind of like the lack of response from us collectively. And so back in December, we kind of pulled together a coalition of brown and red race activists. We're calling One Land, One Struggle, to really be in solidarity with our black relatives and brothers and sisters, and to also lift up the names and the faces of our relatives, and also bring attention to some of the unique ways our community has been impacted by police terrorism, particularly through a lot of those sobriety checkpoints in the barrios. It's not uncommon, for police to just set up these sobriety checkpoints, and we know oftentimes they have nothing to do with sobriety. It's all about just trying to criminalize our folks who are undocumented, kind of hem them up, jack them up, confiscate vehicles, arrest them, place ICE holds as part of the SCOM and secure communities and all that other kind of business, right? And so, there's unique ways our community's also been targeted. We look at the federal system right now has, the largest population in the federal prison system right now is actually made up of Latinos, is made up of our folks, and the largest population in California Department of Corrections. And so we know that's a direct result of, racial profiling in the way, in the unique way that our community is targeted by police. And as a result of that, we often also experience abuse that it becomes invisibilized. It's never reported or documented oftentimes. So, so that's one of the things what we've been trying to organize around, and also really recognizing that our destiny is intricately linked to that of our black relatives, and that we have a common pain, a common oppression, and a common struggle. And so, I say all that to just kind of really illustrate, that one of the things we really wanted to begin to kind of do too is look back at our roots. And, for us uniquely in movement building, culture's always been kind of front and center. And we wanted to kind of go beyond not just some of the actions to shut down business, but we wanted to do some stuff that was really focused around community building, around intergenerational, community building too. So that means like bringing the young people, the children, the grandmas, the grandpas, our elders and our children together, familias, and really kind of lace our folks up on all these issues just through kind of like what we call edutainment. And so that was kind of the intent and purpose of this event, March 15th. It's also really a part of celebrating the Chicano and the Black Arts Movement, the 50th anniversary of those, but we're just kind of focusing it on some contemporary issues, so namely police terrorism, issues that I've just been kind of taking time to describe.
Most definitely, man. And, unfortunately, this is also becoming natural in our barrios, and in that sense of, where police are basically using the fact that some of the raza doesn't know their rights, for example, we had frisk and seizure, there's a lot of violation of that going on too within the police department when they come out to the barrios as well, so
Yeah, stop and frisk, certainly our community was impacted by, you know, as well. You know, I mean, stop and frisk was just kind of a code word for racial profiling. You know, even a lot of language that used to be, you know, something that, you know, was used to kind of affirm rights. Like, you know, people used to refer to our constitutional rights. Well, now they call them, you know, they call this constitutional policing, but it's really just kind of a co-optation of language, you know, and we've seen patterns of that by right-wing kind of reactionary efforts, you know, like when they tried to abolish affirmative action, they called it the California Civil Rights Initiative, you know what I mean, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, man, we've seen these attacks, you know, systematically, you know, on many different angles and fronts, but the one right now that I think, you know, has really become, you know, out of pocket, really, particularly in the post-September 11th political climate, has been police abuse. It's like we've given a license to police since September 11th to pretty much get away with murder and do whatever they want. There's no accountability, you know, when there's physical abuse, when there's murder, when there's rape and harassment, there's just no accountability. If you have a badge, you have a license to pretty much do what you want.
And talking about that, you know, we see that, you know, you were talking, mentioning about the nation uprising, you know, where we see, like, because of the fact that this is going on, you know, where, for example, we have Alex Nieto's case here where, you know, four cops were let go, no charges, you know, and basically we see Oscar Grant, you know, the cop did only 2 months and then they got out, basically, you know. And so basically we're seeing that, you know, when it comes down to the actual process of getting even just into the court system is really what is frustrating to a lot of the community members who have to go through this horrible experience of having their, you know, relative or loved one be shot or brutally beaten by the police.
Absolutely. And, you know, as we're, you know, kind of coming to the close of February and we're creeping into March, you know, March 21st is going to mark the one-year anniversary of the murder by San Francisco Police Department of Alex Nieto. And so, yeah, you know, the San Francisco and Alex Nieto is another example of one of our folks, you know, who is a victim of police terrorism, you know, a young man whom I knew personally who was, doing positive work in the community, who was just having a burrito in the neighborhood that he grew up in. And as a result of a lot of the gentrification and new residents there, you know, a brown brother in his own neighborhood out there, you know, in Presidio, all of a sudden, you know, becomes and looks suspicious, you know what I mean? And the police came and they shot him. They shot him down for no reason, you know, because they thought they claimed that they saw a gun, which was actually a taser, which he was, licensed to carry because he worked as a security guard, you know. And the double standard being, you know, a lot of, you know, for white folks, you know, they're very quick to just kind of believe, you know, and just kind of dismiss and sweep these kinds of issues under the rug. But let's look at the double standards, man. We see white folks wielding guns, open carry. We see white folks do egregious things all the time, in terms of you know, doing things that could be perceived as threatening or dangerous. But you'll see the police response is fundamentally different. They'll walk, they'll talk them down. They'll take time to what it really kind of illustrates is just the way that they value human life, a white life, carries more weight and is more significant than the lives of people of color. You know, they're quick to execute and then ask questions later when it comes to black and brown lives.
That's right. You know, talking about, for example, another example would be Trayvon Martin, when we have this neighborhood watch guy carrying a gun in his car, you know, literally, shooting someone in public, you know, where we see that his treatment was totally different than what someone else who would have been, of color, you know, would have been treated like if they were supposedly claiming to be neighborhood watch, you know.
Yeah, and so what I say that to remind your listeners that, you know, the 21st does mark the one-year anniversary of the killing of Alex Nieto, and there's going to be community action. And, you know, thankfully the Mission community has really been organizing and standing up, once again, kind of in that spirit that I described, you know, for us, Movimiento is all culture is always the front and center. Like when they've been organizing in San Francisco, you know, you'll see that they'll have the danzantes, you know, Aztec dancers out there leading the marchas. They'll have lowriders. They'll have, you know, community. They'll have local bloco out there, you know, out there with the drums and, you know, and jamming out. So, you know, so they're actively resisting, and they're, you know, and so the organizing work on the ground of shutting down business and letting us, you know, demanding and letting the, you know, the systems leaders and the elected officials, you know, who allow these police, you know, this police terrorism to kind of be swept under the rug and, you know, letting them know that, you know, we will not conduct business as usual, you know, is part of the strategy. And another part of the strategy is making sure that we're also taking time to educate our communities. And so that's the reason why we're taking time to kind of organize this block party, so that we're going beyond just, you know, kind of preaching to the choir in terms of, you know, our folks who already are very familiar with these issues. But, you know, because unfortunately, you know, we have a lot of abuelitas and people, you know, who, you know, who they, you know, they listen a lot to the media. You know, they get their information from the media, and they listen to their pastors, or they listen, you know, to whomever. But they're not really, you know, but the thing is that they still have confianza, they still have trust in these systems and these institutions, and they don't really, you know, and they come from a generation that may not question authority and that kind of deal. And so we really want to make sure that, you know, particularly, you know, our children who are generally getting their information from schools, right, you know, and, you know, and the same sort of systems that are, you know, kind of supporting each other. And, you know, and our abuelitas who might be getting their information from the noticias and things like that, that they're made, that they're getting the real deal, you know, kind of information about this. And we don't succumb to, like, classic divide and conquer. You know, some people, you know, a lot of the stuff that was jumping off, you know, around the national movement building with Ferguson, you know, and Mike Brown with Eric Garner and so on and so forth, you know, a lot of that movement, people saw that, well, that's the black community. Those are black issues. And yes, they are, and they're also brown issues. And you know, we, you know, since time immemorial, you know, we've been in solidarity. People, this isn't something new that we're asking in terms of this kind of black and brown unity. This is something that's been taking place, you know, since colonialism, since 1492. You know, when our you know, what a lot of people don't do is acknowledge Latinos as indigenous people, people, you know, who are rooted to this land by our indigenous grandmothers, you know, who've been colonized in our own homeland, you know, and our African relatives who were uprooted from their homeland and you know, and colonized within the context of the United States, that, you know, there were slave uprisings of indigenous and African people, you know, all across the Americas, you know, and that, you know, many, many tribal communities also served as sort of safe havens and refuges for, you know, people during the Underground Railroad. And even across Latin America, we still have these maroon societies, you know, where indigenous people and African people, you know, both slaves, you know, came together and created these, you know, these safe havens in these communities, you know, to maintain harmony and peace, you know, for themselves and their families to live in freedom. And so, you know, this isn't something new, what we're requesting, you know, and what we're, but, you know, but that kind of education is necessary. And we look at the intersection of the African and the indigenous diaspora, you know, it's reflected in our music and in our culture. And so, you know, this block party March 15th and, you know, other events that we're going to be having coming up is really just to kind of make sure that, you know, from the children to our elders and, you know, and ourselves, that we're taking time to celebrate and, you know, our culture, but to also educate and to begin to build movement, you know, so that we're, you know, it's not just, you know, a few hundred of us maybe showing up for the marcha, but eventually maybe a few thousand and more and so on and so forth, you know.
That's right, you know, and so when we're talking about the media, you know, we're seeing a lot of, for example, in Texas, where there's been an uprising of 2,000 prisoners who are now being, you know, separated and moved to different facilities. But basically, they were, you know, uprising against this, you know, fact that they weren't getting medical services, right? And so when I use the word prisoners, for example, it just makes it sound like, you know, they're all criminals, you know, but this is an immigrant facility where, you know, there's also nonviolent offenders there that ended up there mistakenly as well, and that ended up having to deal with this situation, you know what I'm saying? So basically it comes down to the fact that when the media uses words like prisoner, they literally criminalize our communities, you know. And the fact is that that stereotype has been on people of color as well, which also comes through the racial profiling of the police, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, and so that's why even unknowingly sometimes we'll use language like even, you know, the language of offender, right? You know, are sort of terms used to kind of stigmatize, or even the fact that when we refer to the youth and justice system, we generally call it juvenile justice. We don't refer to it as children and youth. You know what I mean? So there's all this kind of institutional terminology that's used to dehumanize and to and to also, you know, and we're oftentimes forced to kind of create these dichotomies of the deserving and the undeserving, right? Nonviolent and this and that. But the bottom line is all human beings deserve certain fundamental conditions and treatment, right? And yes, it's true, because this was an immigrant detention facility. You have a lot of folks who, you know, were merely arrested simply because they've been criminalized based on immigration status and for no other reason, you know. But irregardless of, you know, we also have our relatives in Pelican Bay, you know, who might have had charges, legit or not, but they're also being dehumanized and their human rights are being violated. So we also, you know, it's incumbent upon all of us to also not try to create some of those dichotomies around who's deserving and who's not undeserving. There has to be bottom line standards that a human being is a human being and no human being is illegal.
That's right. And, you know, they're always going to be a part of a family too. And, you know, they have relatives that are on the outside looking in, you know, trying to make sure they come out as well, you know. So, again, it's not just about forgetting our relatives that are in there and trying to call them criminals and whatnot. And in reality, you know, love is stronger than any type of stereotype or border that separates us, you know.
So that's part of the work we're doing. What I haven't mentioned yet is just to let people know March 15th, it's happening on 44th and International, just down the block from High Street. Really want to try to bring out the community from that area, you know, Fruitvale area, East Oakland, bring the black community together, the brown community. You know, that's really our intent with this event. But, you know, other folks who are also kind of thinking about these issues and interested in just kind of coming and checking out the model or just, you know, learning or celebrating with us and maybe taking this and back to their own neighborhoods, you know, we certainly invite and welcome to be a part of it too. This is an event that's being kind of, it was being led by Eastside Arts Alliance, our organization, Community United for Restorative Youth Justice, co-sponsoring it, One Land, One Struggle, Onyx, you know, Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, and a whole lot of other folks in solidarity. You know, we're going to have car clubs out there. You know, we're going to have kids activities, face painting. We're going to have a canopy of, you know, grandmothers. So, you know, our abuelitas and our black grandmothers circle sharing and exchanging, you know what I mean? And in order to kind of reflect, reintegrate so that we can begin to build forward movement, that, you know, we're going to go back to those old ways by listening and taking our direction from the grandmas.
Most definitely, I hope. And, you know, the one thing I wanted to ask you was, you know, because you're out there in Oakland and, you know, tell us what you're doing with your organization. You know, what are some of the things that you guys offer and resources that you have?
Yeah, sure. Well, Community United for Restorative Youth Justice, we're on 2013 International. You know, we were born out of the organizing to stop the gang injunctions here in Oakland, and we've continued to thrive and expand. We work with young people who have been systems impacted. We have school-based programs. We have Freedom Schools where we do leadership development for former incarcerated folks to really kind of, you know, our whole theory is those people who've been directly impacted are the ones best equipped, you know what I mean, to be sort of the change makers, to improve conditions for our people, you know, who are being similarly impacted. And so, we're really trying to elevate voice and power of people, you know, of our community members, you know. So particularly young people and young adults who've been formerly incarcerated. And those who are currently incarcerated, as much as we're able to touch them as well. We're also developing a social enterprise. We're trying to reestablish old indigenous trade routes, you know, so we're buying, you know, organic certified coffee directly from our relatives, the Zapatistas in Chiapas. We're going to be opening up a coffee shop and employing, you know, some of our young people who are on probation and parole, you know, but it's also going to be a bookstore. It's going to be a place for community building. It's going to be an art gallery. And it's going to be a place, and it's also going to kind of serve as sort of a resistance to a lot of the gentrification that's spilling out from San Francisco into Oakland right now. You know, we're not trying to allow, big box retail like Pete's Coffee or Starbucks to come in and kind of displace mom and pops. We're going to be there to really, be a coffee shop that's for the community, by the community, that's been there, so that's some of the work that we're doing. But we also do a lot of policy systems change work. We had two bills signed by the governor last session, AB 2060 and AB 2634. The latter one, AB 2634, was also a police abuse bill. That was authored by Assemblymember Bradford. That was a civil rights bill that created expanded remedies for victims of police abuse. So when we're able to prove a pattern of civil rights violations by a particular law enforcement agency, victims of police abuse before, the only recourse they had was to sue for monetary damages, money. But, you can't put, especially when we think about, families like Oscar Grant, you can't put monetary value on a human life. These are relatives we'll never, ever see again. And you just can't put a dollar value on that. And, when you talk with the family members, that's not what they want. What they really want is justice, and they want to have some assurance that this will never, ever happen to another family again. And so what our bill did is it expanded remedies for victims of police abuse so that now they can actually ask judges, and judges can place injunctions on law enforcement agencies so that there's policy and systems change to address those patterns of abuse. And, those civil rights delay, violations of behavior. So that was kind of a game changer that was signed by the governor last session, and AB 2060 was a reentry bill to create employment opportunities for formerly incarcerated people as well.
Right on, man. Well, we're good looking out, and definitely, it's good work you guys are doing. And if folks want to check out more of the work and get in contact with you, how can they do that?
Well, we're located at 2289 International Boulevard. They can check out our website at www.curyj, as in Community United for Restorative Justice, .org. They can also hit our Facebook page, Community United, at Courage. I don't know the Facebook page, man, off top. But, if you type in Community United for Restorative Justice or Courage, URYJ, should pop up on Facebook. And so, we invite people to come check out the block party, build with us. And if I can too, man, I'll just share, I shared two policy victories from last session, two bills that were signed by the governor. We're currently working on a new bill. And our current bill is AB 256. The author is Joan Sawyer. We're co-sponsoring it with the California Attorneys for Criminal Justice. This bill is going to expand Penal Code 141. And what Penal Code 141 was it made it a felony for a police officer to plant, destroy, or tamper with physical evidence. Keyword being physical. So our bill is going to expand it to include digital evidence, because in this day and age, a lot of our young people, a lot of our community members, a lot of our familias are documenting police abuse through our smartphones, through digital technology. And if a police officer were to delete that, there's no consequences. Our bill will make it a felony for a cop to do that.
Wow. Well, it's good to know, and definitely sounds like something we could support right here. And if you got more information, or, if you got any events around that, please let us know for sure.
Gracias, carnal. Thank you so much for having me, bro. And, really appreciate you always creating the space, and KPFA being just kind of a beacon and, for us to kind of be a voice for community as part of this quest for social justice.
That's right, and one last thing would be that, you're focusing on black and brown uniting, out here in the streets in Oakland and San Francisco Bay Area nationally, And so the idea is that we've also seen it in the prison systems happening, where we never saw it before to this level where, it went from prison to prison to prison. And even recently we've seen it in Texas, right, where mostly, we had racial barriers that would separate folks from organizing a whole prison. And so now we're seeing that those barriers are coming down. Can you just tell us a little bit about what you think about that and how we can connect to that, which is happening inside, and how we can bring it out here?
Well, most certainly. I think that's in many ways also a whole other show, man. And I have, you know, a lot of our close comrades who've been doing solidarity work with the hunger strikers in Pelican Bay, where there's been that, you know, there's been a call for unity among the inmates, you know, because they realize, you know, among not just black and brown, but among all the inmates, right, and all the different prison organizations, you know, that they have a common pain and a common oppression and a common struggle. And so, you know, those points of unity, I mean, you know, anybody who knows a little bit about the inside, you know, understands, you know, the influence that the inside has on the streets. And the potential for this, you know, if they're calling for peace on the inside in our neighborhoods, man, is phenomenal. You know, people talk about, you know, wanting to stop street violence. But, you know, the interesting thing is that our elected officials and many, you know, many systems leaders and particularly law enforcement, you know, have been really, really quick to try to dismiss, undermine, and break up that kind of unity, man. You know, and it reminds me, too, of, like, you know, right in the wake of the L.A. uprising with the Rodney King verdict, you know, you had, you know, many, many communities, and you see it right there on the walls of L.A. It's a, you know, Crips, Bloods, and Essays United. That'd be some of the first graffiti that law enforcement wanted to go and paint over and erase. Cops would dress up as certain homies from neighborhoods in order to kind of get funk started again with neighborhoods that had already united. And so there was a lot of sort of new age COINTELPRO to try to get neighborhoods warring again. So it was like they really didn't want peace, man. In fact, the idea of our communities uniting scared the hell out of them. So it's just important for people to kind of think about that, be mindful of that. And, you know, like I said, that's probably a whole other show, man, and I'll be happy to maybe, you know, come on with some of my folks and maybe or refer you to some of my comrades who've been more directly involved with the Pelican Bay work to kind of expand a little bit more on that topic.
Most definitely. And that was, you know, definitely something, because to acknowledge that we can all unite inside and we can bring that concept out here as well is something we want to do, because, again, it's happening inside and they can do it. We can also support by doing it out here, you know?
Absolutely. Well, hey, brother, thanks again for having me on the show, man. Appreciate you coming out for creating that space, and appreciate KPFA, and I appreciate the KPFA listeners.
Once again, gracias, George Galvez, for being with us right here on KPFA 94.1 FM. And right now we're going to take a quick music break. Stick around, and thank you for all your good work, too. Keep it up, and we'll talk to you soon. Peace.
Peace.